Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Markets go down too, gang. You know that. They are supposed to. What matters is why. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, today, the 27th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This was one of those days where the spread of global economic unease could be tracked by the sequential closings of the major stock indices. Tokyo and Shanghai, down a lot. Europe, down a lot. American markets, down a lot. The cause, of course, is the spread over the weekend of the coronavirus. 80 now dead in China, 2,800 more infected, a handful of cases in other countries, including here. The Chinese government, meanwhile, has extended the New Year holiday by an extra 3 days, hoping that'll help contain the virus. But it's going to come, those closings will, with some real economic costs. To talk about them, we've got Marketplace's Jennifer Pack on the phone from Shanghai. Hey, Jennifer.
Hey, Kai.
So first of all, tell me what it's like when you walk out the door of your apartment onto the streets of Greater Shanghai, would you?
Yeah, Shanghai is not officially under lockdown, but it certainly feels like a ghost town. I came out from the office tonight at 8 p.m. I've never seen the streets that empty. But the people I do see on the streets, they're all wearing face masks. And, you know, regularly we do have face masks for pollution protection. Yeah. But now I guess it doubles up to protect us from the virus. But I have to say it's quite pleasant to get on the subway because it's nearly empty now.
The really excellent Shanghai subway, I would add. What about mask supply? I mean, can you get them if you need them? I imagine they're flying off the shelves.
Well, the pharmacy right outside my apartment, they sold out. Wow. But as I said, Shanghai residents, they already had a supply of face masks anyways because they're very aware of pollution. Yeah. Maybe not everyone was wearing it. So, of course, people are searching for it. But certainly the government wants to make sure that everyone is wearing one so that they can protect themselves and stop the spread of this virus.
So to the government and this extra 3 days of holiday, a couple of questions. Number one, what's it going to mean for workers?
Well, what it means is that they have to stay home longer. And what does that mean in terms of pay? Yeah. Well, it really depends on what industry they're in. So we know that factory workers, for example, will be probably hit the hardest because they don't get paid unless they work. And we understand that even before the holidays, they were being sent home early on unpaid leave because the factories were not getting enough orders. I anticipate office workers that they would be following the rules, and so they are supposed to be paid. But it's a very complicated system here in China because we call this a 7-day holiday, but in actuality, only 3 days are paid. The other 2 days, they have to make up by working on 2 separate Sundays. And the reason the government does this is because they want people to travel and spend. But of course, here in Shanghai, the government and also in Suzhou, they're asking businesses to extend this holiday for another week. So, of course, that's going to hit businesses.
Yeah. And those businesses, they would just take the hit in their own bottom line, right? I mean, it's not like they're going to be made whole by the government.
Exactly. But I have to say, you know, this is a tough economic environment. And what's really fascinating is that in the last couple of years, bankruptcy rates have gone up because the government has made it easier for businesses to declare bankruptcy. And in some of those cases, we have asked the employees, like you'll see workers saying that they have not been paid for months, sometimes even for a year. And they will say, well, we understand that it's a bad economic time and it's happening industry-wide. What am I supposed to do? Jump to another company? And there's this real mentality that, you know, the work unit is like their family.
Right.
So if they work hard, then maybe they can help the company get out of the bad times and they'll get paid.
Yeah. Last question, a little bit off topic, but what's the buzz, what's the vibe about the government's response to this? Any sense of that?
Well, as you know, people are not allowed to criticize the central government, but they are allowed to criticize the local government. And a lot of the anger has been directed towards the mayor of Wuhan, which is at the epicenter of the outbreak. And he actually came out in an interview with the local media admitting that they responded too slowly or released the information too slowly. And this is part of the problem about containing this virus, is that people just do not trust the information. So that's kind of breeding into this whole outbreak and why it's taking so long to contain it.
Jennifer Pack in Shanghai. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street, as I said, followed the rest of the world down, less far down at the close than at the open, for what that's worth. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. At the risk of incurring the wrath of listeners who'd thought the trade war was behind us, oh, for simpler times. Yes, there is that partial China deal, and yes, the USMCA is set to be signed this week. But late this past Friday, on the theory, I guess, that there's no tariff like an old tariff, the Trump administration said it's expanding the steel and aluminum tariffs from way back at the beginning of this whole thing. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
The Trump administration plans to hike tariffs on items made mostly of metal, an extra 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum, for items like wires and nails and staples. After the original tariffs made raw metal more expensive, U.S. manufacturers, like Tom Gold of the Acme Staple Company in New Hampshire, had a pretty predictable predicament.
So our cost of raw materials obviously went up on an immediate basis.
When the materials for his staples went up, so did his prices. He held on to his customers. Acme makes specialty staples, but a lot of other U.S. manufacturers struggled. Inu Manak is a fellow at the Cato Institute.
You have all these producers who, instead of bringing in the primary steel and aluminum products and making something out of it, are just going to buy those products somewhere else.
The Trump administration says new tariffs will help protect the industries harmed by the first tariffs, which Christine McDaniel at the Mercatus Center says creates a
cascading tariff effect, where first we have tariff on steels. Next, we have tariffs on products that include steel.
Which is what economists predicted might happen at the beginning of the trade war. In the meantime, for Tom Gold at Acme Staple, this could be a win.
I'm hopeful that this will enable us to compete more evenly, not just with China, but a lot of staples come from Europe as well.
Assuming no legal challenges and no pushback from Congress, the new tariffs will kick in on February 8th. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
From the steel and aluminum tariffs to the Section 301 tariffs, those are the ones at the heart of the China trade war, there has been a behind-the-scenes paperwork fight going on. Thousands of companies have applied for tariff exemptions, a relative handful have gotten them. So for today's installment of our series, My Economy, what happens when the tariffs go away, at least for a little bit?
My name is Mehdi Farsi. I'm the co-founder of State Bicycle Company from Tempe, Arizona. State Bicycle Company was started in 2009. The founders were myself, my brother, and a high school friend of ours. If you remember 2008, 2009, you know, there weren't a lot of options. So going the entrepreneurial route was always appealing. The three of us were all interested in bikes, and we decided to kind of pursue the bike business. When we did hear about the tariffs, we had the tough conversation with, you know, employees saying, you know, even if we're busy, we're probably not going to be able to bring in extra help, and salaries are going to kind of stay put for the foreseeable future. But in all reality, our overwhelming sentiment was, you know, the Walmarts and Home Depots of the world aren't going to like tolerate this. Like, they bring in so much stuff, like, it's going to, you know, blow over in a couple of weeks or a couple of months. We didn't think it was going to drag out as long as it has. We had filed an exemption for single-speed bikes that we bring in every month, sometimes multiple shipments per month. So just in a few short months, it was tens of thousands of dollars, close to $100,000. The day that we got the trade exemption was pretty surreal. As kind of more information came in, kind of in real time, we found out that it was our application that actually got the exemption for our product that we're bringing in. So that was pretty wild that, you know, a small company from Tempe, Arizona was able to get an exemption, whereas, you know, companies that are several times or even several hundred times larger than us didn't have success in that. January 1st, 2020, we were able to offer benefits for our full-time employees for the first time. So with those savings that we're picking up and the hopeful eventual rebate of the tariffs that we did pay, that allowed us to do that for our employees.
Mehdi Farsi, he's the co-founder of the State Bicycle Company. They're in Tempe, Arizona. Do let us know what's going on in your economy, would you? There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. With the understanding that people might be a little jittery today with coronavirus and an ugly day in the markets and politics, one is reluctant to add to the mix, but data from the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas shows that global real estate and residential property investment overall, and again, this is globally, they're all losing steam together. Sarah Chaney had the piece in the Wall Street Journal today. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Kai.
I guess the most basic question is, why is this happening?
Right. There are a variety of factors that have led to this slowdown in both home price growth and residential investment that we've been seeing over the past couple of years. One of them is that we've seen a broader global economic slowdown, which has kept a lid on housing demand and home price gains in many nations. And there have also been some geopolitical concerns, think the U.S.-China trade war, Brexit, protests in Hong Kong that have dampened buyer sentiment.
Talk to me about, there's a word in this headline that caught my eye, and you address it briefly. I want to talk about the synchronized nature of this thing, because here we're talking about the global market that is, in some degree of unison, slowing down a little bit.
Right. That was one of the really interesting things that I found, because when we think of housing, we think, you know, it's a non-tradable good. Mm-hmm. It's not something like a manufactured car part or soybeans that can be traded across nations. However, we have seen an increasing tendency for economic growth and interest rates to move in parallel across nations. And then another factor has been what we've seen occurring in large global cities like London, New York, Vancouver. Wealthy investors kind of swooped in to buy properties in these markets, and in effect, housing prices became synchronized across those cities.
You mentioned interest rates a couple of times, and certainly here in the States and in other places, central banks have been cutting rates in part to benefit the mortgage market. Not helping, maybe?
So in the U.S., for instance, we did see that the Federal Reserve cut interest rates last summer. And home sales since then have done pretty well. But there's this question of how low can interest rates go? They're historically low. And so one of the economists I spoke with said, hey, the benefits that we're seeing from interest rate cuts, if we have seen them in some other countries, can only go so far.
Right. It bears a mention here that while big picture-wise, a synchronized global housing slowdown is not necessarily a great thing. If I'm in the market for a house, I'm in favor of this.
We have seen that affordability constraints have been an issue, especially in larger cities. Yeah. And so, yes, I would agree that this is a good thing for some home buyers. However, I think that the length and the depth of the slowdown is what's really the concern here.
Sarah Chaney, she's an economics writer at the Wall Street Journal. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me, Kai.
Coming up,
70% of all commercialized bees in the United States are now being used to pollinate almonds.
And those almonds are keeping those bees very, very busy. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, here you go. The Wawa's Dow Industrials off 453 points, 1.5%, closed to 28,535. The NASDAQ down 175 points, 1.8%, 9,139. The S&P 500 gave away 51 points, about 1.5%, 32.43. Travel and transportation companies took a hit, as you might imagine. Delta Airlines sank 3.3%. United Airlines fell 5.2%. Norwegian Cruise Lines down 3% today. Visits to the Chinese gambling center of Macau are down, and so too are the companies doing business there. Las Vegas Sands slipped 6.7%. Wynn Resorts declined 8% today. On the other side of the coin, though, Clorox, which of course makes disinfectants, up 1%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.59%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Once more to the coronavirus story we go, because it is a big story that is still growing. Stocks we told you about, oil has been getting whacked too. The U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate down another 2% today, near three-month lows. Some of that is panic selling, to be sure, but as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, there is some concern that the coronavirus could mean we are in for a longer-term drop in flying and driving and manufacturing in one of the most critical of oil-buying economies. Here's Scott.
China is the world's number two oil consumer behind the U.S. So as Beijing announced more restrictions on air, rail, and car transport, S&P Global Platts put Chinese oil demand on what it calls negative watch. Claudio Galimberti heads demand analytics there.
What's spooking the market right now is the uncertainty. We don't know if this virus will be contained. This has the potential to be really a game changer.
Still, this morning, as the international, or Brent, price of oil fell below $60 a barrel, Saudi Arabia's oil minister said OPEC can cut supply if needed to stabilize prices. In other words, keep calm, says Christopher Haynes at Energy Aspects in London.
When the price got to around $60, that's when OPEC really started to step in, and they started kind of signaling that, you know, they're monitoring the situation just to give the market a bit of confidence so it doesn't fall out.
But oil markets aren't all about confidence and psychology. Analyst Michael Tran at RBC Capital Markets is consulting artificial intelligence.
We used geolocation data to essentially track human foot traffic
inside airports, and they found no drop-off in airports outside China.
So in other words, jet fuel demand destruction is currently a Chinese issue. It's not yet an international issue.
A contained problem for now. The Chinese government has, however, banned overseas group tours starting today. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Apologies for being the bearer of bad tidings, but today is the official first day of tax season. The IRS started accepting returns today. And over the next couple of months, tens of millions of people are going to be finding out whether they are going to be getting a check or writing one. And that made us remember something we covered last time around. Last tax season, you might remember, was the first one under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the GOP's tax code overhaul of 2017, after which a lot of people had been guessing tax refunds would drop significantly. In the end, though, refunds fell only a little bit. Marketplace's Mario Segarra looked into what happened.
Here was the argument. The law gave most people a tax cut. But, well, I'm just going to let 2019 Mariel take it from here.
Yeah, tax rates went down. And when that happened, the IRS told companies to withhold less in taxes from people's paychecks. So that tax cut, you're getting it now. At the same time, the new tax law got rid of or limited a lot of deductions you take at tax time.
Thanks, Mariel. So the IRS and accountants and news programs predicted that if some people didn't change their withholding, they'd end up owing the government money. This is what we saw happening early last year. 57-year-old Guy Harbuck, who lives in Illinois and was used to getting a small refund of a couple hundred bucks, he owed $1,900 last year.
Property taxes in Illinois are very high. So I lost $4,500 of deductions.
By mid-February, the average refund had fallen by 17%. But then come tax day, it was only down by less than 2%. What's the deal? Nicole Kading at the National Taxpayers Union Foundation says, first of all, the early numbers were misleading. A lot of people took a while to file their taxes last year.
And the individuals as well that were likely to see a refund were small business owners. And they tend to file a bit later in the filing season.
Also, Sharon Kreider, a CPA in California, thinks the final refund numbers are evidence that people heeded the warnings and changed their withholding.
They were listening to the media reports and listening to what their accountant was saying.
And she says you've got to keep in mind an average is just that. Some individual taxpayers, like Guy Harbuck, fared much worse than the average. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
If you had almond milk in your coffee today or on your cereal, maybe the nuts themselves from which the milk comes probably came from the enormous almond industry here in California. So many trees that they take up just about the same amount of land as Delaware. Powering all those trees are billions of bees shipped in from all over the country to pollinate. But as Annette McGivney reported in The Guardian the other day, it is risky work for the apiary workforce. Annette, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kai. Thank you.
Tell me about this guy, Dennis Arp, this beekeeper that you start your piece with.
So Dennis Arp is a beekeeper in northern Arizona. He's been keeping bees for three decades or more, and he started out just starting to keep bees for honey production. But then he got in the 1980s, started renting out his bees to almond growers in California. So he now splits his business between keeping bees just for honey production and selling honey in the regional area around Flagstaff, and then sending his bees to California for almond pollination.
And what we come to learn in this piece is that in taking his bees to California for almond pollination, that is not good for his hives.
Right. Like Dennis Arp and all beekeepers are subjecting their bees to some very big risks by sending them to California to pollinate almonds.
What's the risk? I mean, isn't that their job to pollinate almonds?
Right. Well, bees, they do like to work hard and stay busy, but the almond industry has grown so substantially over the last 15 years that 70% of all commercialized bees in the United States are now being used to pollinate almonds. And in 2000, the almond industry was producing 700 million pounds of almonds. In 2018, 2019, it was 2.3 billion pounds of almonds. That is a lot of work that bees have to do.
So why is Dennis Arp and why are all these other almond farmers, or beekeepers rather, why do they keep doing this to their bees?
Well, they've got themselves in a situation where it's so profitable to send their bees to California. They get paid $200 per hive. The second largest crop in the United States that's pollinated by bees is apples, and apples only fetch $53 per hive. So it's very profitable for the beekeepers. But it also costs them a lot because beekeepers are losing at least 30% of their bees every year. They die, you know, directly or indirectly from the pollination that's happening. And so they are spending money to keep their bees alive and do things to try and meet their almond contract.
Yeah.
And so they're spending this money, they're going into debt. And so they need to increase their revenue to pay their debt. So they're in a catch-22 situation.
Yeah. And not to get all capitalist here, but that's what the money's for, right? They're getting $200 per hive for almonds over 50 for apples because of the risk, right? I mean, that's the deal.
That's right. The almonds fetch $200 per hive because they're in right. such demand because the quantity of almonds that are being produced keeps increasing,
right.
whereas the number of hives in the country has stayed the same since 2000.
Yeah, should this is not a one-to-one comparison here, but should we feel bad for drinking all this almond milk, those who drink almond milk?
Well, I don't think you should feel bad in terms of just drinking any plant-based milk is so much better for the environment than dairy. But it's true that you should maybe take another look about almond milk and kind of the impact on bees that goes into making that almond milk.
And Emma Givney is a writer and journalist based in Flagstaff, Arizona, writing in The Guardian about beekeepers and almonds. Annette, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Sure. Thank you so much, Kai.
This final note on the way out today actually came out Friday and I missed it, but here you go anyway. Gallup did a survey at the end of last year about Americans' leisure and entertainment activities. So the most common thing that we do, leisure and entertainment-wise, any guesses? Tell you what, I'm going to give this a minute because actually you're not going to guess. The most common thing we do? Not movies. Good guess, though. That was number two. The most common thing we do for entertainment and leisure in this country is go to the library. I kind of love that. All right, we're done. Dow Industrials off 453 today, 1.5%. The NASDAQ down 175, that is 1.8%. The S&P 500 off 51 points, 1.5% there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.